Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. This is our telephone talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us this morning. The Tale of Genji is generally recognized as the world's first novel. It was created by an 11th century Japanese court lady that we know as Murasaki Shikibu. It was a book that was in her time, these stories, were in her time very popular, and the stories have continued to engage people ever since. There are a number of translations in modern Japanese that have been done by Japanese writers. It's also available in other languages, including English. But about the creator of Genji, we know relatively little. We don't really even know exactly when she was born or when she died. And it was in an effort, I think, to flesh out her story and to give her more of a complete life that our guest this morning undertook a novel, which she titled The Tale of Murasaki. Our guest is Liza Dalby. She first went to Japan when she was a teenager, became interested in Japan and Japanese culture, went to college and did a PhD in anthropology. For her dissertation, she decided she wanted to study the role of the geisha in modern Japan, and she went back to Japan and did research, made friends with some geisha, and established a relationship with them. And then they suggested the way that she would really understand what geisha and the geisha life was all about was to become one. And she did. In fact, she has the distinction of being the first and only Westerner ever to have become a geisha. She wrote a book about that titled Geisha, which is still available. It's now out in a paperback version. This morning we'll be talking about this most recent book, The Tale of Murasaki, which just a couple of months ago came out in paperback. It's published by Anchor Books. As we talk with Liza Dalby, you should certainly feel free to join the conversation if you like. If you have questions, you can call here in Champaign-Urbana, the number 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line that's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455, 333-WILL, and toll-free, 800-222-WILL. Ms. Dalby, hello.
Yes, good morning, David. How are you?
I'm fine, thanks. And thank you very much for talking with us.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
What was it that, obviously, you were interested in or grabbed by Japan, Japanese culture, when you were fairly young? Do you know when exactly that happened or what it was that started you on along this road?
Well, you know, it wasn't clear at the time, but, you know, as so much else happens in one's life, when you look back on it, you see the path that wasn't obvious at the time. And ironically enough, it was The Tale of Genji, which I read when I was 16, and was completely swept away by this work of literature. I mean, for me, that was the first time I really experienced the power of a great work of literature that can just pluck you out of your time and place and put you somewhere else. So that was really my introduction to Japanese culture. And sometime later that same year, after I just graduated from high school, I had a chance to go to Japan through a business connection of my father's. So I hadn't really been thinking about it that much, but all of a sudden this chance kind of appeared out of the blue, and I thought, well, okay, you know, that sounds interesting. And, you know, with really no more planning than that, you know, went over there as a teenager.
I think probably if people have in their minds images of pre-modern Japan, they are probably formed by people like James Clavell and Akira Kurosawa.
Uh-huh.
And that Japan in that time is different from the Japan of Lady Murasaki, which was a long time before.
That's correct.
What was, and we can continue to talk about this in different ways, but maybe we can start off, I could start off by asking a question. Japan at that time, at her time, what was it like?
Well, the amazing thing about, say, the 10th, 11th century in Japan, it's called the Heian period, and it was kind of a golden age of courtly elegance. The beginning of the period was really steeped in Chinese culture because the Japanese had borrowed so much from China because that was the close, great culture. And they borrowed a writing system, the courts structure, architecture, clothing. But then they closed off the contacts with China and kind of blended all of these Chinese elements into something that was quite different. And it was in a way kind of a hothouse flower of a culture lasting about 300 years, which degenerated into a period of warfare, I'd say about 100 years after Murasaki's death. But as when it was in existence, there was just an amazing flowering of literature and aesthetics in all sorts of fields, in music, in architecture, in clothing. So it kind of, looking at it from hindsight, it's always kind of glowed in the distance as this golden age.
Hmm. And I think one of the things that people read Genji for and are fascinated by is the picture that it offers of this very, relatively speaking, I guess, small and closed world that involved the court and the ruling class of the time.
Well, yes, and it was a world that was ruled by aesthetics and poetry. In a way that it's a little bit hard to imagine from, it's very different from Western ideas of chivalry and romance, but I think the reason that we have such a clear picture of that age is largely due to Murasaki Shikibu and her novel, The Tale of Genji. And she was such a skillful writer that she manages to draw you into this world, and so you come to believe in it.
Mm. There are some things, apparently, you can learn about her from Genji. There are also some fragments of diary that have remained. So we have some things that she wrote about herself and
That's
her
right.
life. But in many ways, she's something of a mystery. We don't know exactly when she was born, when she died, and perhaps just a few things for sure. We know who her father was and what he did. We know she got married. We know that she had a daughter. But past those basic things, there's an awful lot that we don't know about her.
Well, that's true. And I think of my novel as I certainly use the historical facts that are known to kind of provide the bones of it, that there are great gaps that I've had to fill in with my imagination as I tried to imagine what kind of person she was. And that began for me, as I mentioned, I read The Tale of Genji when I was very young and then have since gone back and reread it many times. And it was only much later, when I was in college, that I read the sections of her diary. And there's such a difference in the voice of this person that comes through in the diary, which of course is nonfiction, where she strikes you as a person who is very unhappy much of the time. I mean, she had been called into imperial service because her writing was so popular, but she never felt at home in court society. She felt that the other ladies-in-waiting were looking down on her. And there was such a gap between this beautiful, glittering world of Prince Genji, which was her fiction, and then this glimpse that you get of her from the diary. For me, that's what spurred me to try to fill in that gap, to see if I could imagine who this person was that was able to write the Genji, but also suffered so much self-doubt and was so honest about writing these things out in her diary. I mean, it's really unprecedented in, you think this was 1,000 years ago, and when we saw, I mean, it was so many hundreds of years before we saw anything like this in Western writing.
Our guest this morning in this part of Focus 580, Liza Dalby. She is an anthropologist by academic training and has done a lot of writing on Japanese culture and society. And her most recent book is a novel about Murasaki Shikibu, the woman who wrote The Tale of Genji. And it's titled, her novel is titled The Tale of Murasaki. It's now out in the paperback editions published by Anchor Books. And, of course, if you'd like to join us here on the conversation, 333-WILL, toll-free, 800-222-WILL. In the novel, we learn about her and her father. Her father is a scholar of Chinese. She has a brother who doesn't particularly have a scholarly bent. And one of the things that she talks about in the book is that their father's a little bit disappointed that the son doesn't have a potential to be a great scholar, but it turns out that she does. Mm-hmm. And she, in fact, even says that that she was able to pick up from the lessons that father was trying to teach her brother. She picked this up just from having overheard them. Mm-hmm. And this apparently comes from her diary, and that, in fact, was what happened.
That's correct. She makes this. She doesn't mention very much about her childhood in the diary, because the diary is written when she's already in court service and, you know, focuses a lot on the ceremonies, especially the birth of the prince that she was invited to attend. But there are one or two comments, and she mentions this about her brother, that he was rather slow, and sort of just grasping that one little mention, and then there are maybe two or three other places in historical sources where her brother kind of pops up, and it's usually because he's bungled something. That's what gave me the inspiration to build the character of her brother as kind of slow-witted.
Mm. And yeah. That's what I guess here I would imagine some of the appeal to you and perhaps other people would be the notion that while other women of her class would have been literate, that it seems likely that she was educated in a way that other women would not have been, and that perhaps she would have been, as a woman, there would have been things about her that would have set her apart and that perhaps would have maybe even caused her some difficulty because she was unlike the other women.
I think that's true, David. And, you know, the women of the court were all educated in the poetry canon. I mean, they had to have been to trade these highly literate poetic references with men, and that was extremely highly valued. But it wasn't considered feminine to know too much Chinese, you know, which is the great tradition that all of the poems are springing off of. And I think there are two things going on with Murasaki Shikibu. One is that she clearly was brilliant. I mean, she had she was a genius, and you know, that's the sort of thing you can't really explain away. But the other thing was that her father was a very highly regarded scholar of classical Chinese. So, you know, she, not only did she have the ability, but she was born into a family where she would have had access to these things. And from other things that happened in her life, I presumed a very close relationship with her father. The fact that we know her mother died when she was relatively young, and the fact that when she was in her 20s, her father took her along when he was posted outside of the capital, way up on the Japan seacoast. And that would have been highly unusual for a woman. I mean, if you at that age, you were supposed to have been safely married off in 11th century Japan. And somehow she managed to convince him that he should take her off to the, you know, to the hinterlands. Mm.
And I think you imagine that, in fact, part of the reason was he was seeking intellectual companionship.
Well, that's not inconceivable, no, because he was leaving the center of civilization. So, yeah, he may have, in fact, had that in mind.
We certainly know what women in Heian, Japan, we know how they dressed. We know how they wore their hair. We know what kind of makeup they wore. We know what they looked like in that sort of way. Is there any indication of what Murasaki Shikibu looked like?
Well, there are only, there's a section in her diary where she talks about how other women look, and she views them with a very critical eye. But we don't have we don't have the mirror image of that, of anyone describing Murasaki Shikibu. Now, you mentioned earlier that there are many translations into modern Japanese of the Tale of Genji, and the latest one was done by a Buddhist nun named Setsuchi Jakcho, and she's just published this 10-volume, the latest modern Japanese translation of the Genji, and it's been a huge bestseller in Japan, and she often goes on talk shows, and people ask her, you know, her opinions of Lady Murasaki. Her opinion is that Murasaki was very ugly and that she retreated into this fantasy life of writing about the tale of Genji because she herself was not attractive. I mean, anybody can put in their interpretation. We don't know what Murasaki Shikibu looked like. In my view, I have her being, you know, relentlessly honest about herself, that this is how I view her from her other writings, and that she was moderately attractive, but she knew that she was no great beauty.
Hmm. We certainly know that women of this period, they wore their hair very, very long. They wore rather heavy makeup.
Mm-hmm.
They tweezed their eyebrows and painted brows on up. Sort of, it gives them a little bit of an astonished kind of look, as if their eyebrows are about to jump off their face. They blackened their teeth.
Right.
What is that's something that I've always been very curious about. And it seems that even today, Japanese women are there's some kind of thing about self-consciousness about showing their teeth. What was the thinking behind tooth blackening?
Black teeth. Well, this is so interesting, and you know, all of these things you mentioned about knowing how women wore their makeup and their hair and their dress, you don't really get this from reading The Tale of Genji. Murasaki Shikibu describes clothing a lot because I think, clothing and how they layered colors would be an aspect of a person's personality. So, you know, she used that as an author in describing the various ladies. But nowhere does she mention blackening the teeth. And these are the kinds of things that, I mean, this is where my writing drew out the anthropologist in me, because I felt I had to know these things about material culture, about the surroundings of life in the 11th century, in order to be able to paint a scene for modern readers. Murasaki Shikibu didn't need to say that an elegant woman blackened her teeth, because all of her readers would have known that, and they could easily have pictured these heroines. But not only did I feel like I had to describe that, but I also had to put it in a context that made it seem that the characters were doing that because they knew it made them attractive. And that involves getting over our own Western notions that the very idea of black teeth is repugnant.
Mm-hmm.
You know, how in the world could that be seen as attractive? So this was one of the cases where I tried it myself, and walked around Berkeley for a few days with black teeth. However, being Berkeley, nobody really said anything. And then I even had my teenage daughter allow me to do that on her teeth so I could just sort of catch a glimpse of what this might have looked like. And what, in fact, it does is it creates a shadow. And when you think that these ladies' long black hair was the most important, you know, aspect of their physical beauty, and the way the eyebrows were done higher up on the face in the midst of a face that's painted very starkly white. In that context, I think that natural teeth would have looked kind of yellowish and unattractive. And so if you replace that with this, the shadow effect, you begin to see how it could have been thought of as beautiful. I even do that now sometimes on my when I do a reading at a bookstore, I blacken my teeth, just because people are surprised that it doesn't look so horribly grotesque. And so they come around to thinking, oh, okay, I see how that whole aesthetic might have worked.
Mm. Also, the women of this period of her class spent a lot of time and took great care in selecting their wardrobe. And the fashion of the time was to wear layers of dress in different kinds of color combinations and different complements. And I think so many so that perhaps you would only even know that because at your collar you would see the different colors of the different robes, or maybe at your sleeves.
That's right.
You
the collar,
would.
The sleeve, and the hems.
Yeah.
And
I'm just, I know one of the things that came along with the book was that in Japan there are so many fans of Genji that there's a place that you can go and they will dress you in Heian clothing, so that you could get the feeling of what it was like.
Yes.
You did that.
Of course, I had to do that.
I, and What did it feel like? I get the feeling that it must have been uncomfortable because you would be carrying a lot of weight, and I would think
incredibly heavy.
It's hard to
50 pounds.
You know, how can you be very elegant and move very elegantly when you're wearing 50 pounds of clothes?
You know, David, I think from your questions, it sounds to me like you've visited my website.
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, well, I should mention that anyone can go to www.taleofmurasaki.com, where I talk in more detail about some of these things. And there's some pictures of me dressed up in my Murasaki outfit. And I had read about, you know, the layering and how that works for many years, including when I did the research for my earlier book called Kimono, Fashion and Culture. And I have a whole chapter in there of this incredible aesthetic of colored robes, and the different sets would have different names and they would change throughout the season. It's just a whole world of color and design that's quite fascinating. And of course, trying it myself, I realized that being able to move gracefully was not necessary. I mean, that was not a part of what made a woman attractive. Mm-hmm. Mostly, they would be viewed sitting still behind blinds or behind curtains. And if you didn't even walk very much inside the palace or the rooms of these mansions, very often you just might kind of crawl along, you know, on your hands and knees in these huge, huge volumes of clothing. So it gave me a much stronger idea of how these women actually live.
How do you have any notion about how that style developed?
Oh, yes. It clearly came from Chinese antecedents. Hmm. But then the way the colors began to be layered to reflect the seasons, this was the Japanese contribution to this style. I mean, you basically, as an aristocratic woman, you couldn't show your face in public, but from behind your screens, your sleeves and the hems of your dress would spill out, and this would be how you showed the world that you were an elegant and discerning person.
It seems in many ways that it would have been an extraordinarily stifling way to live.
Certainly from a modern American perspective, yes. Yes. I mean, they didn't. If anyone has been to Kyoto in the summer and you know how incredibly hot it is, it would be a mistake to think that the women were wearing 12 layers of robes in the summer. Mm-hmm. You know, in the summer, they would wear just one layer, and usually it was a sheer layer, so their whole upper body would have been visible underneath that one sheer robe. So it also depended on the season.
Mm. Well, I guess I'm thinking of stifling in a more metaphoric
sense, in a social way
that one was living in a way where behavior was so circumscribed that one could easily feel trapped. And I think that you, at least in your book, you suggest that that's the way that she at court. That's the way that she did feel.
Well, I think spontaneity is such a huge value in modern Western society that it's a little bit hard to imagine a society where spontaneity was completely not valued. I mean, even in poetry, you weren't supposed to come up with, if you came up with something totally original, people just wouldn't know what to do with that. What was valued more was how you knew the old forms, you could allude to them in what you did, and then maybe just add a very slight twist. And that was true with clothing color combinations. The idea wasn't to come up with something totally new and, you know, outrageous that would be considered fashionable. It's how you understood, how you showed that you understood what the tradition was, and then maybe put a little twist on it.
Hmm. We're at our midpoint here. We're talking with Liza Dalby. Her new novel is about Murasaki Shikibu, the woman who created the Tale of Genji, the world's first novel. Her book is titled The Tale of Murasaki, and it's out now in paper, published in paper in August, so it's been a couple of months. from Anchor Books. It's out there in the bookstore if you'd like to read it. Questions, of course, are also welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. If one wanted to read Genji and you don't read Japanese, you don't have all that many choices in English. And I think that there's a new translation that's coming out soon if it's not already out. I wonder, do you have a particular favorite?
You know, David, that's something, and people often ask me which translation of the Genji I prefer, and I've had a chance to read the new version, which is done by Royal Tyler, and I believe that's out this month, October, from Viking, and it absolutely sets the new standard. So for people who have not read The Tale of Genji yet and are wondering which one, without any qualification, I would say read this new one. It's quite marvelous.
Well, I've read a little bit about it, and it sounds very good. Now I have to figure out how to convince Viking to send me a copy.
Aha!
Which I don't expect to be able to do. But you know, if I had any strings to pull, I'd definitely be doing that.
I'll see if I can put in a good word.
Oh,
for you.
Thank you very much. No, I appreciate that. We do have a caller to talk with in Charleston. Well, let's do that on our line number 4, our toll free line. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I tuned in late, so forgive me if I ask something that you've already talked about, but I read Memoirs of a Geisha, and if I remember correctly, in the acknowledgments, the author acknowledged you, and I believe he mentioned that you are the first Western woman to become a geisha. Is that correct?
That's true, and my book called Geisha, which is nonfiction, was a big resource for Arthur Golden as he was writing his novel. And I should say that my book went out of print during those years, and it's really due to the success of the novel, Memoirs of a Geisha, that my book came back in print.
I was wondering if you would tell us how you became a geisha, how you convinced a geisha house to allow you to do that.
I should say, first of all, the program we're mostly talking about Murasaki, but it seems that my geisha past always comes back to haunt.
You'll never escape it.
Well, it's funny because I've written about, you know, both of these aspects of Japanese culture, people are tempted to draw the connection, whereas in fact Murasaki lived, you know, a good 500 years before there were any geisha. To answer the caller's question very briefly, I went to Japan to study geisha as, you know, a profession for women and existing within Japanese society where women usually have been discouraged from taking on a profession. And, you know, the fact that geisha didn't marry and that they lived in communities of other women made it very attractive as a subject for anthropological research. I certainly had no idea when I started my study that I would become so deeply involved, and it was only when I reached a point that I think the geisha saw that I was serious that they invited me to join them in order that I could really understand what their lives were like. So it's not as if I walked into Kyoto and knocked on the door of a geisha house and said, you know, hello, I'm an anthropologist, and I'd like to try out your life for a year. I mean, something like that would never have worked.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
All right. Well, thanks for the call. And I did mention before, but I could at the beginning, but I should mention that the book, The Geisha, is now available again, and it's quite interesting. So that's another possibility if people would like to read about it, that story. And it is, as Liza Dalby just mentioned, it's nonfiction. It is her account of her participant observation, I guess that's what you call it, in the business of what the geisha life is like. So that book is out there, and I think it's quite interesting. Let's talk a little bit more about Genji. This, for people perhaps who have taken a survey course in Asian literature or perhaps in world literature, they may have read parts of it. And indeed, there may be people who have read the whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
This is a story of this man, Prince Genji, follows him throughout his life, and even the story continues after Genji is gone, and some of his two of his sons we read about in
son and grandson,
and it is episodic. It follows him throughout a number of years, and talks about his various relations with various and sundry women.
Yes.
And it was very popular in Murasaki's time. People apparently loved it. They passed around copies of it. There were a lot of bootleg copies probably of Genji floating around.
This was how literature was disseminated because there wasn't printing yet. So, you know, ladies would basically copy it by hand and then distribute it.
What in that time for people who were living, who were contemporaries of Murasaki, mm-hmm. what was the appeal of Genji?
Well, you know, there were like folk stories and there were histories and obviously poetic diaries and things, but there had never been anything of the scope of Genji until Murasaki Shikibu wrote this. I mean, she basically invented this whole genre right out of her head. I mean, I think of it as something of a literary miracle. And you imagine that many of these ladies who were of the aristocracy, they had an awful lot of free time on their hands. Mm-hmm. And I think they must have been very bored and probably very depressed a lot of the time. I mean, if you look at the vocabulary for describing depression in classical Japanese, it's clear that this was an emotion that was experienced by many, and they were looking for a way to kind of escape and mentally. And these tales were so engrossing that that you can see how women, not only women, but men also, would be very anxious for the next episode to come out.
In a way, it's easy to understand the appeal of the character, and yet he also is a remarkably selfish, self-absorbed individual. And in fact, over the course of the stories, darker aspects of his character do come forward.
Yes. I think that's very interesting, the way the character of Genji develops. It seems to me natural to assume that Murasaki began writing The Tale of Genji when she was quite young, with no idea that this was going to turn out to be this massive extended tale, but just episode by episode, story by story, and each one is rather independent, and it was only later that it kind of got knitted into a larger structure. And at that point in her life, she probably thought very consciously of the development of her character. Mm-hmm. But he definitely changes, and I think, and the way I made the scenario in my novel, is that this was probably very influenced by her own experience of court. Because before she actually went into court service, it must have appeared like this glamorous world that she knew something about, but she was never privy to. I mean, her rank was, and her father's rank were relatively low, so she would not have been a familiar at court. So she was free to imagine it as beautifully as she wanted. And then later, when she was actually in court service, you know, then she experienced all the political bickering, the dark underbelly, or what's behind the curtain.
Mm-hmm.
And naturally, that would have affected her writing. So I think it's not surprising that her writing then took a darker tone.
I suppose that some people might quibble whether or not Genji was a novel. And they might say, well, what it really is a collection of linked short stories, but I think you could make the argument based on the fact that the way it's told, that it follows the character over time in a chronological way, and that also you can see character development, you can see change, that it really is more than just a collection of stories.
Oh, that's true, and it's also a very interior work. Mm-hmm. You are there inside the heads of your characters in a way that you don't see in Western literature, for hundreds of years. I mean, it's very modern in that sense. In fact, some of her, you mentioned how, you know, Genji himself dies a little more than halfway through the tale, and then it's taken up by looking at his descendants, and one of them is full of angst and doubt. I mean, he's a very modern anti-hero in a way, and I think that explains part of the appeal of this book, that you can read it 1,000 years later and feel that you're inside the heads of these people.
Mm-hmm. I think what one of the things that I did was I went to my shelf and I hauled down an ancient Asian lit survey book that I had from when I was an undergraduate, and it's got a chapter from Genji in there. And the commentary on it suggested an interesting metaphor. It said that some people think about this, the metaphor is the scroll, the illustrated scroll, which Chinese and Japanese certainly would have known about. And that is that it may tell a story, but what you do is you unroll a little bit of it and you look at that part, and then you have to roll it up again and roll out some more. And that it's in that sense, it's episodic. Things are linked, but it's almost as if when you're finished with the one part, that part's gone.
Uh-huh.
And when you go on to the next thing. And it seems that in a way that is kind of like what this story is, the way that the story unfolds, or maybe the way that people would have read it, perhaps over a long period of time in little bites.
I think that's absolutely true. That's a very good way of characterizing it. It's not plot-driven in the way that modern Western literature is. And so I think as a modern reader, when you approach something like The Tale of Genji, you have to read it with a different eye and sort of read each chapter on its own in a way. It's almost something you can kind of open up. If you've read it through once, you get a basic idea of what it's about. It's something you can go back to and dip back into, and you read it differently. Also, at different points in your life, I think.
Yeah. I think it's interesting the point you make about it not being plot driven. I suppose some people would say, well, if not plot driven, then what? It's really it is as you suggest, very much about character.
Right.
It's character driven, and but it's also very much about place, about mood, about the way that people thought about the feeling of life.
And also how human emotion is reflected in nature and vice versa, and those things are woven together in this aesthetic sense that, you know, really characterizes the Heian period. I think that's what draws a modern reader. Yeah, I mean, that's what makes you stick with it, because, even in translation, it's very, very long, but it's like opening a door into a very different world, and while you're reading it, you feel like you're part of that world.
So, in her time, was she? Would we think of her as being a celebrity?
Yes, I think she was, because her rank was not sufficient that she could have had any social advancement from that, and. You just get the sense that everybody read her tales. Yes, I think she definitely could be called a celebrity.
Given that, as you say, they were very popular, people passed them around, and what people did was they made copies.
Yes.
And then they passed them on, and no doubt copies were made and passed on. That seems to be a recipe for introducing all kinds of mistakes, or for other people to write things in that weren't there.
Exactly.
How does one arrive at what is the definitive version, and that version that we would say, this is what Murasaki Shikibu wrote herself, and no one came along and either goofed it up accidentally or intentionally?
Well, you know, David, there is a huge industry in Genji scholarship in Japan, and there's all sorts of debates about which chapters were authentic and which weren't. I followed a kind of interesting scenario that has three chapters in the middle. They're kind of a bridge between the death of Genji and then this when the story really picks up again with a more sure voice that talks about his descendants. And there's three chapters in the middle that are kind of, they don't necessarily belong there or anywhere, and some people have thought that these were spurious. Someone else wrote them and they just got stuck in later. But that's not the official line. Is that Murasaki wrote the whole thing, and I thought it was interesting to take one of these sort of sidelines of scholarship, and in fact suggest that three of them were spurious. But you never know. I mean, there's a whole school of thought that says Murasaki didn't write the whole last section, these 10 chapters called the Uji chapters. And some people think that someone else, perhaps her daughter, wrote those. That scenario was suggested by the woman who first translated the Genji into modern Japanese in the early 20th century, because before that time there was no way that Japanese could actually read it, even though, I mean, you had to either be a scholar of classical Japanese, or, I mean, you knew the iconography because, you know, it's a situation where the work is very famous, everybody knows the characters, but nobody actually went back and read it because they couldn't. Classical Japanese is so different from the modern language that you have to make a special study of it. But in the early 20th century, this woman poet named Yosano Akiko translated the whole thing into the modern language so people could read it again. And her opinion was that the last part of the Genji was finished off by Murasaki's daughter. You know, again, who knows?
Mm-hmm.
Scholars don't tend to believe that now, but when I was writing the novel, I originally thought that that would be an interesting way to finish it off. However, when I got to that point in my narrative, Murasaki's daughter is 16 years old. Here Murasaki has, you know, suffered through these years of court life and much self-doubt, and she's rather depressed. I mean, who would you think would have written these dark chapters, the 16-year-old or this woman in her 40s who had kind of seen it all?
Mm.
And it was clear to me that Murasaki herself had to finish it off, that was the only thing that made sense.
We have another caller here, someone in Urbana to talk with. Let's do that. Line number one.
Hello?
Yes, hello.
I have Tales of Genji on my bookshelf, and I have not read it. I certainly will now. But the question I have is that what I've noticed about Japanese modern literature and the movies like Kurosawa, that they have, there's an entirely different sense of time. Do you know what I mean?
As compared to, say, Western movies?
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah. And is that present in the Tales of Genji?
Yes, I think so.
That everything moves very slowly and you're paying attention to each detail.
Yes, and you focus on a particular scene instead of thinking, okay, where is the scene trying to pull me?
Right.
Yes.
Uh-huh.
I think that's definitely true of the Tale of Genji and Japanese literature in general. And I think that influences what you see in Japanese cinematography as well.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it's a very different sensibility.
Yeah, it's very appealing, I think.
Very appealing? I think so.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you for the call. I think we're getting a second caller here lined up. We have about 5 minutes left. 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana. Toll-free 800-222-9455. And again, yes, here's another caller. In Urbana, line two. Hello.
Hello. I wanted to ask us if she's seen the 17th century screen that our local Krennert Art Museum has based on the Tale of Genji. It's from the school of Iwasa Matabi. I don't know if I'm pronouncing that correctly, but it's Matabei.
You know, there I have not seen that one in particular, but one of the other influences of the Tale of Genji is that it was so popular that it became the inspiration for all of the other arts, the no drama pictures, you know, screen paintings. So there would be, there are many screens, you know, throughout the centuries that are done on the themes that come from the Tale of Genji.
I would encourage local people to go check it out in the Asian Gallery. It's quite nice. It has the scene of him courting.
Uh-huh.
And then the other side of the screen is when he's leaving in exile on a horse.
Uh-huh.
So just wanted to add that.
Sure. That's something.
Thank you for calling.
That's something that's on display all the time?
I'm not sure if they rotate that one out, but okay. It had been part of the permanent Asian Gallery.
Great. Very good. Well, thank you. Let's go here again to line number one. This is another Urbana person.
Yes, good morning. I listened to the caller who talked about mood and time being very slow And I wondered if the author used that mode in her fictional account of this famous person's life, and or does she have a more modern Western feel to her book?
That is such a good question, and it was such a struggle for me because the book is written in the form of a memoir that Murasaki writes at the end of her life as she's trying to come to grips with this fictional character, the Prince Genji, that she's created, who then, as fiction does, somehow it attains a life of its own, and she found that it was influencing her life as well as, even though he's her creation. And what I wanted to do was try to infuse my work with the kinds of things that I love about this literature, the emphasis on the scenes themselves, the importance of poetry in pulling the story along. That Murasaki's own work, The Tale of Genji, is threaded with these poetic exchanges that Genji has with his various lovers and everyone else. And so I tried to include that in my book. At the same time, of course, I'm writing for a modern Western audience, which has expectations of how a novel is supposed to progress. And so I was very conscious of this balancing act of trying to, open out scenes, but it also had to have a storyline that, so that readers would be able to kind of jump in the river of it and flow along. So I felt that I added a great deal of plot. From my perspective, although reviewers tend to see it as not being plot driven, as being mostly an exploration of characters.
In your book as well.
I'm talking about in my book, yes.
Mm-hmm. Was she invited to court because of the popularity of her books?
Yes.
Ah.
Yeah.
Okay.
And I think she felt rather ambivalent about that, and this is how I portray her in my novel, coming out of the hints that you see in her diary when she talks about feeling depressed and really very self-conscious of being in court.
Huh. Well, thank you. It sounds fascinating. And the name of it again is?
The name of my book is The Tale of Murasaki.
Okay.
And that works off the title of her famous novel, The Tale of Genji.
Right. And would you spell your last name?
My last name is Dalby, D-A-L-B-Y.
Thank you very much. This has been a fascinating hour.
Well, thank you for the call. And I guess to all that information, all I can add is that The Tale of Murasaki is now out in a paperback edition. It's published by Anchor Books, so you can go out and find it in the bookstore. And there, Ms. Dalby, I think we'll finish. I want to say to you thanks very much for talking with us today.
David. I must commend you for having done your homework. You're very, very, by far the most knowledgeable interviewer that I've ever spoken with.
Well, I appreciate that very much. I thank you for your time. Liza Dalby, our guest, again, The Tale of Murasaki. It's out now in paper if you would like to read the book. And it's a fun read. Take a break now. We'll have news at 11:01. Right now, an update on the markets. Please stay tuned.